Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. It's a situation no one wants to be in, when the oncologist tells you there's nothing more I can do for you because you've exhausted all known treatments. But what about the newest drugs and approaches that haven't been tested on your particular type of cancer or haven't been proven to extend life? How do you decide whether something is worth trying that may be incredibly expensive and might have horrible side effects? Two of our articles today look at these questions that are currently facing patients and doctors now that immunotherapy is holding out a tantalizing possibility of cure. And we start today with an article from the New York Times written by Gina Collada and published on April 26, 2018, and where I got the title for today's show, the title being Desperation Oncology: When Patients Are Dying, Some Cancer Doctors Turn to Immunotherapy. Dr. Oliver Sartor has a provocative question for patients who are running out of time. Most are dying of prostate cancer. They've tried every standard treatment to no avail. New immunotherapy drugs, which can work miracles against a few types of cancer, are not known to work for this kind. Still, Dr. Sartor, Assistant Dean for Oncology at Tulane Medical School, asks a diplomatic version of this. Do you want to try an immunotherapy drug before you die? The chance such a drug will help is vanishingly small, but not zero. Under rules of desperation oncology, you engage in a different kind of oncology than the rational guideline thought, Dr. Sartor said. The promise of immunotherapy has drawn cancer specialists into a conundrum. When the drugs work, a cancer may seem to melt away overnight, but little is known about which patients might benefit and from which drugs. Some oncologists choose not to mention immunotherapy to dying patients, arguing that scientists first must gather rigorous evidence about the benefits and pitfalls, and that treating patients experimentally outside a clinical trial is perilous business. But others, like Dr. Sartor, are offering the drugs to some terminal patients as a roll of the dice. If the patient is dying and there's a remote chance the drug will help, then why not? Immunotherapy is a particularly nuanced problem, said Dr. Paul Helft, an ethicist and oncologist at Indiana University School of Medicine. Cancer doctors are well aware of the pitfalls of treating patients before all the evidence is in. Many still shudder at the fiasco that unfolded in the 1980s and 90s when doctors started giving women with breast cancer extremely high doses of chemotherapy and radiation on the theory that more must be better. The doctors did not systematically collect data. Instead, they reported patient anecdotes claiming success. Then, a clinical trial found that this treatment was much worse than the conventional one, the cancers remained just as deadly when treated with high doses, and the regimen itself killed or maimed women. But immunotherapy is like no cancer treatment ever seen. It can work no matter what kind of tumor a person has. All that matters is that the immune system be trained to see the tumor as a foreign invader. Tumors have mutations that stud them with bizarre proteins. The white blood cells of the immune system try to attack but are repelled by a molecular shield created by the tumors. The new drugs allow white blood cells to pierce that shield and destroy the tumors. Last week brought yet another example of the surprising power of this approach. Lung cancer patients who normally would receive only chemotherapy lived longer when immunotherapy was added, researchers reported in a clinical trial. But the drugs are exorbitantly expensive. One that Dr. Sartor often uses costs $9,000 per dose if used once every 3 weeks and $7,000 if used once every 2 weeks. Often he and other doctors persuade a patient's insurer to pay. If that fails, sometimes the maker will provide the drug free of charge. Immunotherapy drugs can have severe side effects that can even lead to death. Once the immune system is activated, it may attack normal tissues as well as tumors. The result can be holes in the intestines, liver failure, nerve damage that can cause paralysis, serious rashes and eye problems, and problems with the pituitary, adrenal, or thyroid glands. Side effects can arise during treatment or after the treatment is finished. For most patients, though, there are no side effects or only minor ones. That makes giving an immunotherapy drug to a dying patient different from trying a harsh experimental chemotherapy or a treatment like intense radiation. The problem is deciding ahead of time if an immunotherapy drug will help. Doctors check biomarkers, chemical signals like proteins that arise when the immune system is trying to attack, but they are not very reliable. A positive biomarker does not guarantee that a patient will benefit, and a negative biomarker does not mean a patient will not benefit, said Dr. Richard Schilsky, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. You don't have a solid biology to go on. It was this problem described at a medical conference a couple of years ago that led Dr. Sartor to begin offering immunotherapy to dying patients. I was thinking, my God, these tests that are used to drive clinical decision-making are not worth a damn, he said. These are people's lives here. We are playing with the highest of stakes. For certain people, it is like bingo. You give the drug to them and they have a long-lasting and positive benefit, he added. When our knowledge is not sufficient to inform our decisions, then we have an ethical conundrum. Out of curiosity, Dr. Sartor emailed 8 prominent prostate cancer specialists, asking if they too offered immunotherapy drugs to patients on the off chance the treatments would help. 5 said they offer it, with a variety of provisos, offering comments like, "If I was a patient, I want my doc to do everything." Dr. Daniel George at Duke University said he does not offer immunotherapy to every man who is dying of prostate cancer. But he said, for those patients who want to do everything they possibly can, that's the group where we try checkpoint inhibitors, a type of immunotherapy. To the others, the majority of his patients with metastatic prostate cancer, he does not mention immunotherapy. We have to balance between hope and reality, he said. The most difficult conversation we have with patients is when we tell them that more treatment is actually hurting them more than the cancer. Dr. Daniel Petrylak, a prostate cancer specialist at Yale, said his inclination was to offer immunotherapy only to those rare patients whose tumors have a genetic marker indicating the immune system is trying to attack. Already an approved indication for prostate cancer, he noted. But this strategy gives him a rationale for trying the drugs on patients with other cancers. With the possibility of a dramatic and prolonged response, he said in an interview, how can you ethically deny this to patients? At the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Dr. Christopher Sweeney said he petitions an insurance company to get an immunotherapy drug when the patient has a genetic marker predicting a possible response, an indicator the drug might work, even if there is, as yet, no clinical trial evidence that it will, and is strong enough to tolerate the treatment. But if those conditions do not apply, as is usually the case, Dr. Sweeney only gives the drugs to patients if he can do so as part of a clinical trial, where something can be learned from their experience. And if there is no clinical trial for the patient, I basically say, I don't have any approved therapies, Dr. Sweeney said. Here's the truth. Most patients don't benefit from these drugs. He tells patients that just because he has no more drugs to give does not mean he has abandoned them. Supportive care can make patients more comfortable, even prolong their lives. Dr. Sartor disagreed with the approach. I would love for every patient to be on a clinical trial, he said, but does that mean I shouldn't try because I don't have a trial? One of the first patients Dr. Sartor treated with immunotherapy was George Villers, a retired investment advisor who lived in New Orleans. Mr. Villers had bladder cancer and had tried chemotherapy. It didn't work. So Dr. Sartor told Mr. Villers that he'd run out of conventional options and asked if he wanted to try immunotherapy. At the time, the drugs had not been approved for bladder cancer. Mr. Valera and his wife, Fran Valera, thought it over, asking themselves whether they would regret if they didn't try. "I thought we would," Mrs. Valera recalled in an interview. Their insurance agreed to pay, and Mr. Valera took the drug for several months. Nonetheless, he died on November 15, 2016, at age 72. He had no side effects, Mrs. Valera said, but the drug didn't do a damn thing. Then there is Clark Gordon, 67, who lives in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. He had metastatic prostate cancer. "A bad deck of cards," he said in an interview. Dr. Sartor tried conventional treatments, but they didn't work for Mr. Gordon. Finally, the doctor suggested immunotherapy. Mr. Gordon's insurer refused, but then the lab that had analyzed his tumor discovered it had made a mistake. There was a chance Mr. Gordon might respond to immunotherapy because he had a rare mutation, so his insurer agreed to pay. Immediately after taking the drugs, Mr. Gordon's PSA level, an indicator of the cancer's presence, went down to nearly zero. "Makes my heart stop nearly every time I think about it," Dr. Sartor said. "Life sometimes hangs on a thin thread." This piece also comes from the New York Times Opinion column, was written by Robert M. Wachter, and is titled "The Problem with Miracle Cancer Cures," and Dr. Wachter is a hospitalist. And this was published on April 19, 2018. "I frequently care for patients with advanced cancer. A majority have already tried some combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Many have landed back in the hospital because the cancer has returned or spread widely and left them in intractable pain or struggling to breathe. The hospital stay is often a time when patients decide to stop aggressively fighting their cancer and instead to focus on palliative care and achieving a measure of comfort and grace at the end of life. The moment of transition can be subtle. It's sometimes signaled by a sweet look from a husband to a wife, a gentle touch of the patient's hand by an adult child, or two simple words, 'It's time.' Over the past 20 years, evidence has demonstrated that palliative care decreases pain, improves comfort, and even in some cases prolongs life a few months. In my experience, conversations about turning to it often begin with patients recognizing that curing their cancer is impossible. Patients sometimes ask for my opinion on this. While the conversation is often heartbreaking, it has rarely been a hard call. But now it is, and that has thrown a wrench into the way we treat patients with advanced cancer. The reason is a new generation of cancer treatments that have become available in recent years. Some, called immunotherapy, harness the patient's own immune system to battle a tumor. Others, known as targeted therapies, block certain molecules that cancers depend on to grow and spread. The medical literature, usually circumspect when it comes to cancer, in light of many overhyped treatments in the past, now fairly gushes with terms like revolutionary and cure. In this case, the hype feels mostly justified. Much has been written about the promise of these treatments, as well as their staggering costs. Many cost several $100,000 a year. But what strikes me most about them is that by blurring the line between cure and comfort, and between hope and hopelessness, they have disrupted the fragile equilibrium that we doctors have long taken for granted. I recently cared for a woman in her 80s, clearly dying of lung cancer. Or so I thought. But what about immunotherapy? Her family wondered. When I reluctantly asked our oncologist about this, he didn't scoff. "It could work," he said quietly, as if not quite believing what he was saying. Oncologists are seeing patients whose cases they once would have pronounced hopeless experience Lazarus-like responses to these new therapies. One of my hospital's specialists in multiple myeloma, a bone marrow cancer with a previously dismal prognosis, recently told me that he'd treated a patient with a new kind of immunotherapy. "I think I cured my first case of myeloma," he said. His voice was filled with awe. This, of course, sounds like wonderful news for patients and their loved ones, and if these new treatments worked most of the time, this would be an unambiguously happy story. But they don't. A recent analysis estimated that about 15% of patients with advanced cancer might benefit from immunotherapy, and it's all but impossible to determine which patients will be the lucky ones. Just last week, a study of lung cancer patients demonstrated the overall benefits of combining immunotherapy with traditional chemotherapy. But here, too, the researchers noted that most patients will not respond to the new treatments, and it is not yet possible to predict who will benefit. In some cases, the side effects are terrible, different from those of chemotherapy, but often just as dire. With patients and family members primed to hold on to every reed of hope, even a small chance of cure or prolonged remission will cause the majority to stick with their pugilistic approach to cancer. In our dichotomous system, one that forces patients to choose between the goal of comfort or cure, this means that most of them will forgo palliative care. We already know that despite the unquestioned value of hospice, many patients with end-stage cancer don't take advantage of it, or do so with only a few days left in their life, having needlessly suffered for weeks or months. Our new uncertainty will probably make this worse. What can we do to alleviate this? First, it turns out that many patients can benefit from palliative approaches even as they continue aggressive treatment for their cancer. In 2016, the American Society of Clinical Oncology recommended that concurrent care, palliative, and active cancer care delivered at the same time be made available to patients with advanced cancer. Rules that force patients to choose one approach or another, particularly those that tie insurance coverage of palliative care or hospice to stopping active cancer treatments, should be scrapped. Second, doctors need more training in how to have these hard conversations with patients in light of the new cancer treatments. Doctors will need to become more at ease with the prognostic ambiguity and better versed in the possible benefits and harms of the new therapies. Finally, through the Federal Cancer Moonshot Program, the government is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to study immunotherapy and other emerging treatment options for cancer. The sooner we can work out which patients will, and just as important, won't, benefit from these approaches, the better. Sadly, for some patients, a cure will prove elusive. As we continue to chase progress in cancer, let's be sure that we don't rob dying patients of a smaller, more subtle miracle, a death with dignity and grace, relatively free from pain and discomfort. And we move on to an article, "A Life-Saving Pump for Cancer Patients is Being Phased Out." And this is written by Denise Grady and Sheila Kaplan, and published on April 25th, 2018, and I believe this is also from the New York Times. A medical device that can add years to the lives of cancer patients is about to become unavailable because its manufacturer has decided to stop producing it. The device, the size of a hockey puck, is implanted in the abdomen to pump high doses of chemotherapy directly into the liver for cancer that has spread there, usually from colon or rectal tumors. The treatment can help prevent tumors from recurring after they're removed from the liver and can shrink inoperable growths in the liver so that they can be cut out. The pumps, which cost from $7,000 to $11,000 each, are used along with systemic chemotherapy that is dripped in through an intravenous line. "I don't know what we're going to do," said Dr. Nancy E. Kemeny, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and a pioneer in using the pump. "We have enough for another month or so." She said her hospital implanted 146 of the pumps last year. Overall, more than 1,000 people have received the devices. "They've increased survival more than anything else in this disease," Dr. Kemeny said. At least 10 operations to implant the pump at Sloan Kettering have been postponed, according to Dr. Michael DeAngelica, a liver surgeon at the hospital. Other medical centers have also advised patients with advanced cancer that the pump may no longer be an option. At Northwestern University, Dr. Ryan P. Murkow said he had only one pump, but many patients who needed it. "Now I have to decide who gets this potentially life-saving therapy," he said. "One patient is about to become a father," and Dr. Murkow said, "I desperately want to help him." The devices, called Codman pumps, are made by Cerenovus, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, which told doctors in a letter dated April 4th that it had decided to stop production effective April 1st because of significant and multiple raw material supply constraints within the manufacturing process. Dr. Kameny said she and other physicians had appealed to the company to keep making the device, but it had declined. "It has likely saved many lives and prolonged the lives of many more," Dr. DeAngelica wrote to the company. "I would implore you to reconsider this decision, if not just for economic or logistic reasons, for ethical reasons." Mindy Tinsley, a spokeswoman for Cerenovus, said demand was very low, with sales of about 300 pumps a year in the United States. "Unfortunately, some of the suppliers that provide the materials, such as titanium rods required for production of these pumps, have elected to exit the business or have found that the required materials are no longer available," she said. The company was still pursuing alternatives, she added, but declined to explain what they were. Angela Stark, a spokeswoman for the Food and Drug Administration, said the agency could try to help but did not have the authority to compel manufacturers to sell a specific product. Another company, Medtronic, makes a similar pump, but it's approved for use in the spine, not the liver. Dr. Kameny said she hoped it could be used for her patients. Medtronic issued a statement saying, "We acknowledge there's an important medical need for these patients, and physicians should use their best clinical judgment when evaluating the use of any commercially available pump outside of its labeling." One obstacle is that the Codman pump requires a catheter that the Medtronic pump lacks. It's not clear whether replacement catheters could be obtained or whether the Food and Drug Administration would allow the adaptation. Patients at Memorial Sloan Kettering who received the Codman pump lived about 2 years longer than those who did not, Dr. Kameny and her colleagues reported last year in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. They looked at 2,368 consecutive patients with colorectal cancer who had surgery to remove tumors that had spread to the liver. They were treated from 1992 to 2012. Those who received pumps survived a median of 67 months, compared with 44 months for patients who did not get them. The result was especially striking, Dr. DeAngelica said, because patients who got pumps were sicker to begin with. The report was not based on the strongest type of evidence, which would come from a controlled study with patients picked at random to receive one treatment or another. But the researchers said the evidence was the strongest that could be obtained without a randomized study. Dr. Kameny began recommending the pump in the 1980s, and Memorial Sloan Kettering has been a leader in its use. Other centers also used it, but many stopped in the mid to late 1990s, thinking that improved chemotherapy would make it unnecessary. But there were still patients who needed the pump. Now, just as the device is being phased out, medical interest in it has started to rebound. And we have, lastly, an article titled "Precancerous: Warning Sign or Cause for Panic." And this is from April 18th, 2018. And I might be wrong about this, but I think this may have come from Prevention. "It might be a spot, lump, bump, or polyp you've found suspicious or bothersome enough to ask a doctor to have a look at it. The doctor sends what she's excised for testing and tells you it's precancerous. But what exactly does that mean? And is it cause for alarm? Our bodies are made up of more than 200 types of building blocks or cells which form your organs, heart, brain, skin, and so forth. Over time, these cells replace each other to keep our organs healthy and functioning normally. Ordinarily, this cell regeneration and the controlled cell death is exquisitely controlled, but occasionally errors are made, particularly in the gatekeeping processes that control how quickly and efficiently the cells regenerate. The process then begins to get out of control. The older we get, and the more times our cells regenerate and replace themselves, the more chances there are for mistakes. This is why we call cancer a disease of age, one that is more likely as you grow older. How is precancer different from cancer? Precancers are abnormal cells which have undergone some changes that we know are associated with an increased risk of becoming cancerous, but are not yet cancer. These changes include alterations to the inherited material or DNA of the cells and the way those cells talk to their neighboring cells in the immune system. As these changes occur, the cells develop the ability to ignore normal cues that would ordinarily signal them to die or stop replicating. This leads to an increase in the number of precancer cells that may be detectable. For example, a mole on your skin made up of melanocytes or pigmented cells, or a small polyp in your colon that shows up during a colonoscopy. Additional or more powerful changes occur to switch these precancers to cancer, and the chance of this happening is different for each cancer. Cancer occurs when cells become completely deaf to normal signals that constrain growth and regeneration, allowing them to start moving away from their proper location, upsetting their resident tissue and other organs around the body. Precancers take a long time to develop into cancer. Many, in fact, will not progress, but some can progress remarkably fast. It's this risk of cancer that clinicians and scientists are trying to prevent. Doctors currently use a combination of the size, number, location, and appearance of precancers together with molecular changes in patient history. For example, exposure to known environmental risk factors such as long-term sun exposure or a genetic susceptibility such as family history of bowel cancer to predict the overall likelihood of cancer developing. This risk assessment determines whether a precancer needs to be removed and the screening interval for follow-up with the patient. This evaluation is based on the best available data, and medical researchers are working hard every day to understand more about what contributes to this risk to identify better, absolute markers for precancers that will progress to cancer. So, if your spot, lump, or bump wasn't cancer, you have found it early, and this is good news. Having a precancerous condition doesn't mean you have cancer or that you will definitely develop cancer. But precancerous conditions might develop into a cancer, so it's important to monitor your health. In addition to regular screening, quit smoking, protect yourself from excess sun, eat a balanced diet of fiber and exercise regularly, and as always, if you have any concerns, talk to your doctor. That's it for today. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well, and please come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.